You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to the program, A Good Book. This is the fourth part of the book, Life for the Bus, An Adoption Story, Finding My Birth Parents, Jerry and Joanne Buss. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close, and I am also the author of the book. This is the true story of finding my birth parents after years of fruitless searching, only to discover that I am the eldest daughter of Dr. Gerald Buss, the multimillionaire, legendary owner of the Los Angeles Lakers, and his wife, Joanne. On the previous broadcast, we learned that we had moved to Waco for the summer, but then after the summer was over, back to Phoenix for second grade. That next summer was spent in Southgate with my Aunt Faye, the Lakers fan, and my Uncle George, the Dodgers fan. Upon our return to Phoenix, we learned that our dog, Laddie, had died. We stayed in Phoenix for my third grade, and I got to experience the Catholic Church. Then another summer in Southgate, and by this time, in 1961, my biological parents, Jerry and Joanne Buss, had given birth to Johnny in 1957, Jimmy in 1959, and now Jeannie in 1961. Now back to the story. Summer ended and we made another long, hot drive home to Arizona. But this year, Dad had purchased a Thermador portable swamp cooler for the car to keep us comfortable. The round cylindrical unit was secured with a bracket on an outside backseat window. Then the window was rolled up high as possible with the vent aiming inside the car. Before we departed, he would pour water into an opening at the top of the cylinder. Once he started driving, outside air would be sucked into the front opening of the cylinder. My sister and I would fight to see who would get to sit closest to the window and be the master of pulling the cord that released a blast of the cool, misty air. I loved getting sprayed in the face, but she just wanted to roll down the window to get some fresh air. I still think it's a neat idea. Christine's not so sure. 1962, 1963, fourth grade, Phoenix, Arizona. For my fourth grade, we stayed in Phoenix, but rented a different home on San Juan Drive, less than 2 miles from the last one. I'm not sure why we moved again, but when you're young, you don't question it. You just go with the flow. Maryvale Grade School, my newest school, was down at the end of our street. Christine started her freshman year at Alhambra High School. I joined the Bluebirds, the younger set of the Campfire Girls. Nothing memorable happened in school that year, except standing in line in the cafeteria to get the Sabin oral sugar cube to prevent polio and being introduced to modern math, new math, which made no sense to me at all. The best part of this school year was finding a new friend 2 doors down. Brenda and I would play along the irrigation canal a few streets over. The canal was all dirt, no concrete, with big cottonwood trees that provided lots of shade. The water rushed fairly quickly at the canal gate, but it was shallow enough for us to climb in, just beyond the rushing water, to play with our Barbie dolls, pretending we were swimming in the ocean. Living in Phoenix for 3 years in a row had benefits. Dad was feeling better again and on the rebound. He secured a position with Western Stockman magazine in Phoenix, beginning as an office manager, handling advertising and public relations, and working his way up to general manager. This position utilized his speaking and writing talents. It was a joyful time for him and for all of us. Bonanza Airlines advertised in Western Stockman magazine, and our family was able to fly from Sky Harbor Airport in Phoenix to Los Angeles at no charge. The airplane was a turboprop with stops in Blythe, Indio, and Ontario before our final destination in Los Angeles. Because we would travel in the summertime, the heat updrafts from the desert floor made the landings bumpy. Frightened that we might crash, I would start to cry, but But by the time we made our final landing at LAX, I was so excited to see my aunt and uncle in Southgate, I would forget all about the trauma of the flight. We purchased our first new car that spring, a 1963 Ford Falcon station wagon, white in color. I had an Easter outfit that year as well, complete with purse, hat, and shoes to match. I admired Jackie Kennedy, and I wanted to emulate her look. Mom loved it. As much as I loved Arizona, I miss my Aunt Faye. I wrote to her on June 23, 1963. Dear Aunt Faye, I haven't been writing you since school was out, and I apologize, but I have been so busy playing that I've completely forgot to write. But we will come to California July 3, 1963. Getting on the subject of traveling, let's talk about you and your family. How are you? I bet you're busy. How is Uncle George? Gee, I bet G.H. and Kay are busy. I hope to get to see Kay's wedding presents. I want to get her and G.H. a present, but I only have 25 cents. I am trying to get or earn money for their presents. How is Duchess? Is he still fat? My cat Nosy is still as playful as a kitten. My bird Pepper is fine too, but is lazy. My turtle is dead. He died on June 13th, 1963. And of course, you know that Poncho is with his owners. Did you know our plum trees are ripe with juicy plums? Well, I must be going now. Love, your niece. In preparation for the upcoming move, my parents had given away my puppy Poncho. My turtle and my parakeet had died just prior to our move. Summer of 1963, back to California. In the heat of the summer, we moved back to California. I was disappointed because I lost my chance of being a campfire girl. No chance of being a Catholic anymore either. Our 3-year stint in Arizona had ended. So did my dad's job. There were certain signals that we were going to move again. I never asked why. Moving was the natural course of events. Mom would begin collecting empty boxes when we went grocery shopping. I was pretty good at helping Mom wrap our glasses and dishes and newspapers. I learned to pack my personal things carefully and efficiently in as few boxes as possible. Mom had a way of making the serious appear not so serious. Smoking her Salem cigarettes and drinking a glass of red wine as she sat at the kitchen table writing letters to friends about our newest relocation. When she took a break, we would play hopching on her beautiful hand-carved wooden Chinese checkers board. A happy distraction. We never owned a home again after Duarte, so moving was fairly easy. We did have pets that had to be transferred, and I had a cat that was skittish about being in a car, so I devised a way to keep her safe when we had to stop at a gas station for gas and a potty stop. I had a big, empty bird cage, so I emptied out the inside perches, removed the bottom tray, turned it upside down, and put the cat inside, slid the bottom tray back in, and then turned it upside right. My cat gave a long, low growl, but it worked. We spent the rest of summer in Southgate. I got a Ken doll that year for my birthday. I introduced him to Barbie. Things were never the same after that. 1963-1964, fifth grade, Glendora, California. Lefetre Grade School in Glendora would be my new place to learn. We rented a home on Loch Leven Boulevard with built-in nooks and crannies inside and lots of greenery outside. I liked fifth grade. School was important to me and I usually breezed through it with good grades, but this year brought disappointment. My new classmates talked about what they had learned in California history in fourth grade, but I missed that class because I was living in Arizona. Now, living in California, I was missing Arizona history being taught over there in fifth grade. Double whammy. Doesn't seem like a big deal, but it was to me at the time. It still bugs me. My sister started her sophomore year at Glendora High School. She was busy making friends and enjoying high school, so I didn't see her very much. She did have a friend, Anne, who had a younger brother, Butch, who thought I was cute. He would invite me over to his house, and we would sit on swings in the backyard and talk about school. I thought he was pretty cute, too. Mom worked nights as a waitress at Bavarian Hofbräuhaus, a German-style restaurant on Alasta Boulevard in neighboring Azusa. The dining room was a big room with family-style wooden tables and red checkerboard tablecloths. Pretty sure there was sawdust on the floor. They served lots of sausages and beer. She loved working there. Her uniform was light blue with puffy sleeves, and she wore a white apron with big pockets. She loved the music and the atmosphere and made a lot of money in tips. On the weekends, I would wait up for her, and when she got home, she would empty her pockets out on the kitchen table so I could organize all the quarters, dimes, and nickels in piles. $10 in quarters, $5 in dimes, and $2 in nickels. I'm still a whiz at rolling up change into paper wrappers, neatly folding the ends and pounding them on the table to secure them. Mom said she enjoyed being a waitress because she wanted to be out with the people. But she often told the story of an encounter on Christmas Eve with a customer who had muffled under her breath that it wasn't right for people to be working on such a holy night. She overheard it as she walked by, and in a very uncustomary response told this woman, "Well, if it weren't for people like you." My mom was not one to show frustration or anger. She usually took it all in stride. Her other encounter from the Hofbräuhaus was one of bravery. One evening around closing time, she noticed four men who had conveniently sat toward the back of the restaurant and were not making any motions to close out their bill. When closing time came and went, they all rose, guns in hand, and ordered everyone to go into the kitchen. Mom was one of the employees who had her hands tied behind her back and mouth taped while the thieves robbed the cash register. No one was hurt. She told us the story that night when she got home, apologizing that she was late and may have worried us. She seemed undaunted, but I think I may have carried her fear inside me for a long time. Sometimes I had trouble sleeping, afraid of the dark. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close, and we are reading the book Late for the Bus. And now back to the story. This was also the year the Dodgers won the World Series in October, sweeping the New York Yankees in four games, and that was good news for me and Uncle George. But the very next month brought the assassination of President John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963, which was devastating news, especially to my dad. 2 days prior to the assassination, on November 20, 1963, my parents declared bankruptcy. Mom was the only one working at that time. A few days later, our family watched President Kennedy's funeral procession as it passed the White House with the flag-draped casket on the horse-drawn caisson. The sadness was paralyzing, and I felt even worse when I recognized Chopin's funeral march from my music memory contest in second grade. A few weeks later, as a result of court-ordered liquidation of assets, our pretty Ford Falcon station wagon, our television set, and much of our furniture was repossessed. I was at home when it all happened. It was a weird feeling just sitting there, watching strangers remove our belongings. My sister Christine recently recalled, "I remember we didn't have a refrigerator and we had to use an ice chest to keep things cool." I had forgotten the strangers took our refrigerator too. Ever the calm one, Mom would try to console me with one of her favorite sayings. "I cried because I had no shoes until I saw a man who had no feet." Somehow that did not console me. Actually, it scared me. Dad was in the hospital again for a short stay during the holidays, diagnosed with diabetes. So I spent Christmas in Southgate with my aunt and uncle. My aunt had the time and the talent to wrap gifts beautifully using handmade adornments of miniature pine cones and red berries and holly leaves. In their living room was an aluminum Christmas tree, the deluxe model with the pom-poms on the end. A separate rotating color wheel magically turned the tree colors of red, green, blue, and amber. I would spend hours on the floor watching the colors change against the silver tree. It was magical, and I suppose therapeutic. This was the Christmas I received, exactly what was on my list. A white cable knit sweater, a gold stingray bike with a leopard print banana seat, and a wooden skateboard. I had the jackpot. The presents were from my parents, but I knew Aunt Faye was my secret Santa. On March 22, 1964, Mom was admitted to the hospital in Glendora at 1:15 a.m. and was not discharged until April 11, 1964, at 12:46 p.m. The hospital report read, "Abdominal surgery, but no details." The house felt really empty now, and I went back to Southgate. Easter was March 29th, so while I was living with Aunt Faye, she let me use her typewriter so I could type a letter to my mother to send to her inside an Easter greeting card. Here's the letter without corrections. I was not quite 11 years old. "Dear Mom, how are you feeling?" "I'm feeling fine. I would like to come and see you. You know I'm underaged. I hope you get well soon. Kay and I went to Huntington Park to get some material for her curtains for her new house. While we were there, I saw 3 new Beatles magazines that she hasn't got. I also saw some Beatle dolls. I might get George Harrison for her, if she pays me back, and if I can borrow the money from Aunt Faye, and if I can get transportation there. I'm learning a new song called The Singing Cowboy. This morning I woke up at 5, but I went back to bed. Then I slept till 9:05, about a half an hour till Aunt Faye got up. I then ate some cereal called Trix. Then Aunt Faye had to go somewhere, so I went up to Grandma's house. There I had another breakfast. This one was bigger than my first breakfast. I had 4 pieces of toast, 3 pieces of Spam, 1 piece of bacon, and a cup of coffee. Don't you think that's an awful big breakfast? I think so. I then brushed Grandma's dog, took out the trash, and dusted for Grandma. Then I came back to Aunt Faye's, did the dishes, dusted, and then I came in here and wrote you this letter. Well, that's all I've been doing. Besides, I think the typewriter needs a rest. Heart and a smiley face. Hand-drawn. My aunt and uncle didn't profess any religion, so there was no Easter service to attend, but we dyed Easter eggs and put in my Easter basket, along with the chocolate bunny, jelly beans, and pretty malted milk candy that looked like robin's eggs. The holidays were a mixed bag. At times I worried about what would happen to me and my sister if one or both of our parents died. By the way she talked, I knew my aunt was worried too, but she always made sure to give me the most gracious and comforting welcome whenever I came to stay. In return, I would dust and polish her big, beautiful, rotating maple wood coffee table and gladly perform any other chore she asked me to do. At the end of my extended stay, my aunt arranged for a piano recital for my parents. I had practiced every day, learning the song about a cowboy. But my left hand always played the timing part incorrectly. Dad said he liked it because it sounded like the clopping of a horse in the background. I continued to play it this way forever, passing up the opportunity to correct the left-hand rhythm. Although I cannot verify it, I believe this may have also been the year my dad joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I never saw him with a drink in his hand and never saw him drunk. But I do remember going to AA meetings at night with my parents and seeing him go to the front of the room and say, "Hello, my name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic." My mom continued enjoying her glass of Gallo wine when she got home from work, but she joined Al-Anon so they could be together in his recovery. In her little blue Al-Anon book, One Day at a Time, the introduction states the intention of the entire book. It discourages dwelling on past errors and disappointments, visualizes the future only as a series of new days, each a fresh opportunity for self-realization and growth. I believe my mom knew this intuitively from the earliest days of their marriage. Just across town in 1963, my birth parents, Jerry and Joanne Buss, would give birth to my youngest sister, Janie. I now had two brothers and two sisters, none of whom knew I existed. Although I was the eldest child, I remained the unknown Buss. Summer of 1964, back to Phoenix. California to Arizona. Again. Time to pack up and prepare for the long, hot drive on a two-lane highway with steep dips where the road went through the desert washes. I'd get carsick seeing the tops of the road as we went over and then back down and then up, then down. We had scheduled stops like Denny's Restaurant in Blythe, but on this trip, we had an unexpected one. Our red and white 1959 Ford station wagon was pulling a wood-slatted trailer Dad had painted red and white to match the car. Our furniture and boxes were packed efficiently inside the trailer and covered with a dark green oiled canvas tarp that Dad tied down with a rope. As we were driving through the desert heat, the tarp loosened and began flapping in the wind, so Dad pulled over to tie it down again. The oil in that canvas made the tarp so hot to the touch that it was the only time I ever saw my dad lose his temper and cuss at an inanimate object. We made that trek so many times. I memorized the road signs once we passed through the inspection station at the border and crossed into Arizona. The interstate was not yet complete, and as we traveled on state highways, we passed a series of signs, Quartzsite, Salome, Winden. Once we arrived in Wickenburg, I knew we were on the home stretch. Just two more signs, Morristown and Whitman, and then we were on Grand Avenue, less than 15 minutes from home. I am guessing that is why we always ended up living on the west side of Phoenix. Living on the east side of town would have added another hour to the drive each time we drove to California for a visit. That summer, Dad's spirits were lifted when President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He loved President Johnson. That may have been the year he started wearing cowboy boots again. Here was a Texan he could relate to. He would get his boots out, grab some shoe polish and a brush and rag, and make them shine. We rented a big home with a pool on 63rd Avenue and Camelback in Phoenix, but we didn't stay long. Dad would test the pool water with a color-coded test kit to see how much acid and/or chlorine to add. My job was to sweep down the sides of the pool with a long-handled white-bristled brush. I spent much more time than necessary, mesmerized by the movement of the water that caused the sunlit reflections on the bottom to change course. It was like looking through a kaleidoscope. This was my favorite house so far, and if that weren't enough, there was a cute boy who lived across the street. I wish we had been able to stay longer, but at least I had lots of time to swim for the remainder of the hot Arizona summer. 1964, 1965, sixth grade, Phoenix, Arizona. By the time school was beginning, we had settled in another rental home on 37th Drive, a charming red brick home with another big backyard. Sixth grade was my favorite year, in school, at home, and with friends. Christine returned to Alhambra High School as a junior, thrilled to reunite with some friends from her freshman year. I attended Catalina Grade School, which was red brick, just like our home. Miss Griffith was my favorite teacher. She was an attractive, tall young woman with big brown eyes, teased black hair, and a Texas accent that rivaled Dad's. I would volunteer to stay after school to clean the blackboards and erasers and help her rearrange desks. I studied hard and made excellent grades. Everything fell into place that year. I was an underarm fastball pitcher on the softball team. Our team placed first, and we won a blue ribbon. For the first time, I sang in a chorus during the school play, Oklahoma. My parents rented a piano and paid for lessons from Mrs. Wynn Hinton, the school's music teacher. I wore my cable-knit sweater for my classroom picture. I was so distracted by all the good things happening, I don't remember worrying about anything. Even my parents were lost in reverie as President Johnson defeated the local favorite, Barry Goldwater. The after-school moments were just as grand. I had a pet horny toad that I caught on the school playground and kept in a shoebox with a lid that I had punched holes in so that he could breathe and see light. Although we called them horny toads, they were actually horned lizards, and you could find them just about anywhere in Phoenix at that time. A lizard has an exoskeleton, and mine looked like a tiny friendly dragon. I'm not sure if he was male or female, but it didn't matter. He was docile and let me pet him. Or maybe he didn't have a choice trapped in that box. After a few days, I felt sorry for him, opened the lid of the shoebox, and let him go. That concludes today's broadcast. Join us on the next program for the continuation of Late for the Bus, an adoption story by Lee Close, author of the book and your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.